Well, hello everyone. I guess welcome to our podcast, Two Asian Dudes Talking. I'm Derek, sitting beside me is Andrew.
Yeah, greetings to all, anybody who's listening. Hopefully they're all people listening. We are basically two first-generation immigrants sharing and talking about experiences on what it's like growing up in the U.S. And on this podcast, we'll share all of our experiences, from things we experienced as kids in grade school to navigating the office environment as adults, and from making new friends to handling old relatives from the old country. Our goal is to give you an idea of what we've gone through and also what we think as adults, you know, what other first generation immigrants might have also gone through.
That's right. And I think, you know, we all have our own stories, and our story definitely is no different than your story. You know, we all have moments where we're, you know, happy in life, sad in life, you know, whatever it is, you know, we hope that through our story, we'll share with you that, you know, you're not alone. You know, there might be folks that are more, you know, stupid, dumber, or F up. Mostly Andrew and I, mostly me. It's just mostly me. And hopefully there are moments where you find our story or somewhat inspirational. No matter what a connection is, we think there's more in common. I think there's more in common between our story and you that's listening out there.
Yeah. And the other thing is, you know, the world is changing so fast that our experiences may soon actually do become unique, or may even just disappear. Or we get older and we can't remember most of the things we've gone through. And for those reasons, we want to share it out into the world, and have, you know, maybe even have a way to memorialize it. Hopefully that our stories will just continue on, you know, in cyberspace, and perhaps even somehow teach the next generation a thing or two about all the things that we've learned ourselves. And maybe you know, throughout these podcasts, you'll hear something that you can relate to, something that might inspire you in some way. Or maybe you just, you know, hear some stories that are pretty entertaining, pretty fun. But in any case, we hope that these are stories that are enjoyable, and that these are things you'll like to listen to. So with that, in this inaugural podcast episode, we'll start by doing a bit of introduction as to who we are and you know, who it is that you are actually listening to out there. So with that, Derek, who are you? Where are you from, man?
That's a good question. That's actually a very interesting question. So in you know, I attend quite a bit of a social event in a business setting as well as a social setting, non-business related. And one, you know, I would say 50% of the time, the first, you know, icebreaker when people try to talk to me is like, where are you from? And I would say probably more than 50% of the time, I would misinterpret that question, thinking, oh yeah, I'm from California, from Los Angeles, Southern Cal. And then you see a puzzling face expression, and you say, okay, where's your origin of country? So I really stay brief on my answers. Where are you from? I would just tell people, which, you know, I came from China, immigrated here when I was 9 years old, and been living in Southern California ever since. So it's not, in terms of question, most of the time I sort of misinterpret that, but I don't know, do you have the same experience?
I mean, I think I mentioned this before, but whenever they ask me, where are you from? I used to hesitate, you know, because it's such a long and almost complicated story that it's difficult to describe in just a single country name or whatever. I used to tell people, oh, I'm from, you know, I was born in Vietnam, and then automatically they assume, oh, I'm Vietnamese, which I'm not. I'm actually Chinese.
Right.
So, you know, and then I have to launch into why, if I was born in Vietnam, how could I possibly be Chinese? So for a while there, whenever anybody asked, I just said, okay, I'm from Hong Kong.
All right.
Because, you know, I spent most of my childhood in Hong Kong. But the issue with that is when I was actually in Hong Kong, the entire time I was actually in a refugee camp. You know, the refugee camp itself was actually like 1 square mile fenced off from the rest of Hong Kong. So as I grew older, it became obvious that I can't really say I'm from Hong Kong, mainly because I didn't live the life.
You're limited in that square mile. Yeah.
I'm limited by that 1 square mile.
Right.
So I have none of the experiences outside of Hong Kong's fence. Yeah. So, you know, if I say I'm from Vietnam, they think I'm Vietnamese. If I say I'm Hong Kong, they assume I have all these experiences that I never really did. And part of me want to say I'm from China, or I'm just Chinese,
right?
And be done with it. But yeah, it's been a tough question. Nowadays, though, actually, now that I'm working, I usually just tell people, yeah, I've been living in California most of my life.
Yeah,
and that's it.
Well, because that's so true for both of us, and you know, where I think it was probably at least 75% of our lifetime are now in California,
right.
Even though that's not, you know, that's what not. People presume when they first meet us. But one thing that I like to go back on is, our childhood obviously is a little bit different, but you know, you and I met in elementary school when we were
right.
fourth grade. You know, that's sort of how we know each other, Andrew and myself. But going back to that identity, I would say the ambiguity behind the identity, who you really are. You can't really identify yourself as, you know, people from Hong Kongese or Vietnamese.
Yeah.
My experience, you know, I guess when going to China, there's more certainty, at least on my side. I was born in China, grew up, I was, you know, in Canton, China, grew up. My child spent probably my first 9 years there. It's, you know, and I came here not through refugee, it's through more of a sponsorship immigrant. Where my aunt, my father's sister, who actually sponsored us, basically she would pledge, you know, that, you know, whoever her applicants are, that they will be coming here to the U.S. and, you know, financially will not depend on the government
right,
for like
right.
10 years or something like that. So it was a much more less challenging, more of a easier way to get to the U.S. than compared to you.
Yeah, because I think our situation when we were in that refugee camp, we basically had to kind of send this. So for all the audiences who are listening, who actually doesn't know, Derek, if you don't know how this happened, was because in Vietnam, in Saigon or southern Vietnam, there's actually a pretty large Chinese community. But then after the Vietnam War, when all the troops from the U.S. kind of pulled out, the North Vietnamese kind of started really cracking down on non-Vietnamese. So, you know, anybody who's Chinese was just being picked on quite really badly too. Their businesses.
By the Vietnamese.
So right. Like if you have businesses or homes,
right.
it's just taken. So. At that time, a lot of people wanted to just leave.
Right.
And the only way they could was basically to sneak out of the country on these boats, fishing boats, like not even good fishing boats, like crappy boats, right? So people would be sneaking out in the middle of the night, literally in the middle of the night with all their belongings, get onto the boats and just take off. And everybody has, you know, pulled their money together to kind of, you know, get this one little boat. And it's a bad boat, and the seas in Southeast Asia are actually pretty rough most of the time. So you have people who are dying most of the time when they leave on these boats. And you know, if you're not dying in the storms, you're lost. You're dying of hunger or thirst, or you get, you know, captured by pirates. I think I read I was a baby at the time, but I've since, you know, read a lot of information on it and history on it, and like. Over half of the people, like 50%, literally just died on the journey.
I don't know the distance between, you know, that part to Hong Kong, but I can surely imagine that's Pacific Ocean, the water's cold,
right,
and anyway, depending on the time of the year, if it's winter time, I mean, it's quite a bit of challenging when you have other people, younger people. It could be quite a rough journey.
Yeah, it was a tough journey. And then the worst part is, the really screwed up part, actually, if you think about it, is when, even if they made it to land, most of the countries in that time would actually kick them back out. So even if you made it to land, they push you back out to sea, and then you're just waiting there and can't go anywhere. It wasn't until like the late 70s when the UN actually stepped in. And through a lot of charities like the Red Cross, that they started establishing these camps, these refugee camps, where the boats can actually land and they take in the people. And so my family got there. My family at the time was just me, and my parents. The three of us were on this right. boat with a whole bunch of.
Now, how old were you when you?
I probably wouldn't have been more than one or two, at most, probably two. Yeah. And then when we landed in the refugee camp, you know, you're just there. There's you know, it's a camp. Nothing's really official. One square mile, like I said, I think mm-hmm. it's about one square mile.
And then I imagine there's just other people like you. I mean, it's like thousands.
Yeah. I think that the camp had about 10,000 people.
Okay.
At its height. Anyway, so in order to get to the U.S., we submitted paperwork everywhere, not just in the U.S., but like whoever's willing to take refugees.
Right.
And I think we basically waited in that camp for about good 7-8 years.
Oh wow!
Yeah. So
I did not know that. So you, which makes sense because by the time you came to the U.S., you're 8, 9, 10
or so. So before the U.S., I was basically in that camp my entire childhood, and you know, it's definitely for me at the time. It seemed, you know, hey, I figured, yeah, it is what it is. It's life,
right? Because so technically that's the environment you grew up in, and you know. You don't know what you don't know.
Exactly.
And if you grew up in that one square mile, that's your home, that's your childhood.
And it's because it is so kind of insulated from anything else, I think it affected a lot of my you know, upbringing, the education level, things like that. Because we learned quite a bit, I think, for a refugee camp. I mean, we had classes, you know, given by volunteer teachers, basically. You know, I remember specific classes like sewing, some artwork. Mm-hmm. I even remember learning English, to be honest. Okay. But the problem was, I didn't know it was English. I didn't know what the heck
it was. It was a language that you can communicate with.
Some language teacher, or some teacher, I remember this distinctly because it was so weird.
Right.
Now that I think about it was so weird because the person who taught English was Indian. I remember that. I didn't know she was Indian. I didn't know what Indian was, but right. I know that she was a doctor, woman who taught us a class, and every day we had to go to this class, sit there, and she would spout gibberish at us. Well, at the time we thought was gibberish, right? And didn't understand it, didn't know what she was trying to get, you know, get us to learn. Just sat in there and you know, and just wasted time in there.
Right, but from that process you learned English.
Yeah, I think I probably did learn without knowing that I learned.
So which is very interesting because when I first met you, and one of the things that I was most impressed going through elementary school is your ability to grasp the English language. I mean, you came here when you were 9, I came here when I was 9 years old. But as listeners can hear, my accent is much stronger than yours. You know, if listeners were to read some of our blogs, they would see that probably Andrew here has probably a much better command of the English language than I do. Not saying that I'm weak, but yeah, that's something that he's always impressed me. Now I know why, because he's got a head start. So I don't feel bad for myself. But what's interesting is that I was born in China. China at the time during the late 70s and early 80s are still going through changes, and it's just gone through it's like a cultural revolution. Right. My family background were. You know, my grandfather are businessmen, and my mom's side, they're educated folks. Because of the Cultural Revolution, those people tend to be hit the hardest. So all the wealth, all the property has been stripped away from them. So we were, you know, my parents were, you know, obviously find each other, but we were left with close to nothing. By all means, we're not starving. Right. Or you know, go out begging. Me and my brother live a fairly stressless life. I remember growing up, we have all the freedoms. We were running outside. We're doing the stuff that we like to do. We, you know, to a certain extent, we need to help out with our parents too. But you know, there's nothing that's, you know, that would say, oh, that's, you know, when I look back from today's standard, even knowing what I know today, I would not say my childhood is harsh. I would say that one experience that I do remember is that even in Chinese standard, I would say that my parents are very, very frugal. Here's a story that I always remember. I was in second grade or first grade, And you know, the school system is there is different. You know, you go to school between 8 to 12, and you basically from 12 to 1, you get to go home, take a nap, and then you come back to school at 2, and then you finish the day off from 2 to 4, 2 to 5, I forgot. But in the morning section, there's like a recess, what we call snack time here. And what you do is that all the students in the class would, you know, basically first second grade, you have a meal, it's like maybe some porridge or some, what we call hall fun, right? But you need to pay extra for it, right? You need to pay extra for it. And my parents were too frugal, too cheap, whatever you want to use, you know, they didn't pay for that meal for me, that snack, not a meal, excuse me. And I vividly remember I was, you know, class of 30 students or so. I was the only student that did not have a meal. So I played it cool. I was like, hey, look, I don't need it. I'm not hungry. I need a snack. But I'm illustrating that to say that I think, we have a decent life, but my parents are pretty frugal.
You know, the interesting thing is whenever I tell people, yeah, I grew up in a refugee camp, they always think, oh, your life must have been hard. Yeah. It must have been tough. But like you said, you know, yeah, it was probably, if you compare it to the standard we're living at today, right now in the U.S., yeah. Obviously it's much lower, right? But that going back to that, what you said, like, you don't know what you don't know. When I was living there in the camp, it didn't seem that hard, at least to me, you know, for kids, you know, I'm in there with that 1 square mile, since it's actually enclosed 1 square mile, you run around and do whatever you want, because there's you can't leave the place. It's surrounded by guards and it's got a fence. You can't leave. And since it's such a small area, everybody literally knows everybody else. So you can't really get in too much trouble. So kids really just run around all the time, day or night.
And I imagine those becomes your neighbor, your friends, your exactly. family, and you watch out for each other's kid. You play with each other.
I mean, it's actually a pretty tight-knit group. In fact, back like maybe, I want to say maybe 2010, the captain who owned the boat that our group came out on passed away. He was living in Denver. He passed away. And my parents, and like literally the parents of everybody who ever used that boat and was also part of that camp, went to his funeral, you know, for a final send-off. And most of those people, my parents still keep in touch with me. Most of the kids, I still can't keep in touch with. Sec, same camp. Mark, one of our friends.
Should we throw out names like that? Okay.
I don't think anybody's going to know who he is. But Mark, right. Let's say, he lived with us in the camp. Was one of our neighbors. I've known him since then, and I still know him now. You know, he's still...
I know him well.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So, but going back to that, you know, life was what it was. Like you said, the meals inside the camp, the education system, since it was kind of done by voluntary teachers, it wasn't really strict.
Right.
But they taught us quite a bit, and we had snacks and things like that, but it was actually provided by the school. Right. We had like UD, you know, bread and then Vita Waitanae. It's like Vita's milk.
Right.
You know, so, but everything was, I can imagine it was probably much harder for my parents because they were actually working.
Right.
Eventually within the camp, they after a couple of years of residencies in the camp, they allow you to get an ID and go outside of the camp to work in Hong Kong. But after you're done working, you just come right back. So you can't really stay out there. So they go out and work from dawn to dusk, literally. From in the morning, you know, they hand me like a $2 coin, $2 Hong Kong coin.
Which is a lot, or is that relatively?
For me at the time, it was actually enough for me to go and buy a meal, like a ramen bowl. I remember because I loved it. You know, the school had this outside cafeteria next to the school. That $2 coin was enough for me to give to the guy and get a big, large bowl, at least for me at the time, was a large bowl of ramen with a fried egg on top. Right. And it tasted great. I still think it's the best ramen I've ever had. I mean, maybe my memory is all skewed, but I think it's the best ramen I ever had. And it was enough for that.
Right. So what were your parents doing? Like, what job did they
have? It's interesting. My dad worked on part of the construction team. At the time, Hong Kong was growing so fast. They were building buildings everywhere. Mm. So he was part of construction, but mostly a day laborer, you know, lift this, carry that.
Right.
My mom, though, got a job as a, you know, trash collecting, like literally going to collect the trash.
Right.
And I don't know what she does with it. But the great thing was she did that around what is a fairly well-off Hong Kong neighborhood. So every once in a while, she would bring back broken toys for us to play with. Literally, like, you know, those, there was once, I remember once, right. She brought back this little cart, kind of like a Hot Wheel, but not powered. It's a manual, right. You have to push it. It had four wheels, except like one of the wheels was missing.
Right.
And another wheel was cut in half. So it doesn't really actually move. And
right.
It's all broken. But she brought it back with her, you know, during her work.
That's your treasure
it.
Right
that's,
there.
That's, yeah, we kept that.
What is one man's trash is the other man's treasure. And I could totally see that, you know, I think even though we're sort of in two different geographic area, so I in my childhood have a lot of hand-me-downs,
right.
You know, as a matter of fact, you know, because me being a younger brother,
everything
exactly. I have is a hand-me-down, including clothing, toys as well. And at the time, my parents were similar. So my dad was actually, initially he started off as a businessman of sort of taking over my grandfather's business, but because of the Cultural Revolution, we lost everything, including land and business. So he had to sort of reinvent himself. And essentially everybody at that time in China, this is 1979, 1980s, he said essentially everybody had to work for what they call a Danwei, right? So basically you become a member of that group and you work for that association. So and he had to become a tailor. So he would, you know, he would have to learn, because he didn't know. He had to learn how to.
Was that assigned?
That was, you know what, that's a good question. I don't know whether that was assigned or he actually picked it. That's a good question. I don't know. Go back and ask him this weekend. so he did that, and my mom, you know, my mom is a unique character, and she also had a lot of pride in herself. So she would never do stuff that she thinks that's below her, at least at that time. Although when we came over to the US, she became a seamstress. Is that the right word?
Yeah, that's the right word.
So she basically sew, and then you get basically a penny a piece, whatever it is.
Right.
Very, very hard labor and blue collar. But back in China, she would be very selective on what she does. And when she had us, she actually decided to stay home and be like a homemaker. So she didn't work, but my dad sort of bring home the bacon. But because of that, I think at the time life in China wasn't that great, and a lot of people were struggling. We don't have toys, we don't have, you know, we have a meal in which we're happy on. So as I learned later in my life, even though me and my brother, you know, go to bed, you know, full every night, my dad actually go through a period where he actually did starve a little bit so that we could have the best food, like we meaning me and my brother. I'm sure my mom probably gone through the same thing.
Right.
But again, to your point, based on our little universe at that time, everything was, you know.
Yeah, everything was happy. Right? Yeah, you didn't
There's
know.
What... No, yeah, hey, dude.
Yeah, it was fun. But, run around, play kids, you know.
Right.
But yeah, and then when we get older, we find out it was crappy.
right. And we learn that when we get here. And that's why reason, you know, your parents, well, want to move outside of Vietnam, that's because you're somewhat forced out there and you know, try to get to a foreign country, and my parents trying to get to the US.
Right.
Now, having get to the US, now having, you know, so I grew up, you know, maybe from 9 to your teenager year, how do you think that is different from, what was the biggest change that you see looking back and comparing the two? What was your first impression? You know, like, this is US.
The thing is, especially from where I was coming from, so within the camp itself, right, the U.S. is kind of like almost a myth, right? At least among the kids, it was like, yeah, there's this fantastic country where there's gold on the ground. You just pick it up anytime you want.
Right. So for our listener here, I just like to pause a minute. So the U.S., the translation in Chinese is, in Mandarin, is 美国. So it literally, if you take the word, take the two word and transfer literal meaning, is Mei means beauty. Yeah. Beauty, beautiful, Guo is country. So
beautiful country.
Beautiful country. So
Yeah, and not only that, right. And then there's also you know the slang of you know California being dumb san,
right?
Gold mountain. There's literally gold everywhere, money
right.
everywhere.
Right.
So you know the kids didn't believe it. We figured, yeah, that's something the parents made up. There's this fantastic country. So the thing is though, at the time through like we used to, in the camp, we had this old television that only got two channels. I don't know where the two channels came from. I don't know what it was, but every once in a while, there would be like channels that the shows that describes the U.S. And then I started to become convinced that the U.S. actually existed, and it is there. I remember when we first came here, I didn't realize that things would be different. Like there would be different. Measurement systems, that there would be different money, there would be different calendar systems. I remember, for instance, when we first came here, I don't remember when it was, but my mom was making a comment about the cost of something being like $15. She said $15 is so expensive, you know, it'd be much cheaper if it was in Hong Kong and so on and so forth. But I was confused because, you know, $15 bucks,
hey, right.
You know, I could use My meal every day was like
your ramen bowl was like $2.
Yeah, that's $2 right there. And then you know $5 could get you a couple of meals, but $50, that's pretty cheap.
Right.
But then it turns out she was talking about you know U.S. dollars versus Hong Kong dollars. So there's a major difference there, and I didn't realize that until I came here. And then various things, you know, the calendaring system. I think I mentioned this before as well. When I was speaking to a teacher here, barely came here, enrolled in school, one of the teachers, a Caucasian woman. I don't know how the conversation came up, but she was asking me when Chinese New Year was, what date was Chinese New Year. At first I was confused. It's like, obviously it's January 1st.
Right.
Why wouldn't it, what other day could it possibly be? Who else would celebrate New Year on any other day except January 1st? Except, you know, I didn't realize January 1st in Chinese New Year is very different from the January 1st here in the U.S. So there's that disconnect of different things, different backgrounds. It's difficult to understand. The language, of course. I remember when I first came, I think one of the first memories I have of learning the language and having difficulty with it was with the letter S. You know,
right.
when things are in plural, you had to say the S at the end, like tables, chairs, you know, there's an S. I don't know for what it was, but I remember my a student making fun of me in class because I was told to stand up and I say, it was actually a math class, and now that I remember,
right.
And I was had to say this, read out this equation. It was like probably 3 + 4 + 5 + 6 or something like along those lines. I remember when I said it though, I forgot the S because I just ignored it. I just said 4 + 6 + 7 + and the kids were laughing at me. It's like plut plut plut, right? And I remember thinking, what a stupid language. Why do you need to add this stuff? Stay the same. If it's
right.
a table, it's still a table, no matter how many there are. But you know, you need that plural in there. So that's one of the things I had trouble adjusting
well,
to.
Yeah, that's certainly a learning experience. So did you start off the same school that where I met
no,
you?
No. When we first came. I actually lived in San Diego for
okay.
about 6, maybe 7 months. So the first school I went to was actually in San Diego, which was much more, a lot more Caucasians, a lot more, but fewer Asians.
Right.
Okay. So, you know, it was a kind of a troubling time because my English skill at the time was really poor.
Well, it's troubling time, but kids sometimes can be pretty cruel.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
there's a lot of jokes around. You know, every time I say something wrong, there'll be a joke about it.
Yeah, no, and I definitely. So I mean, there's right there common ground between Andrea and I, where I first came here, landed in Los Angeles, and I was staying with my aunt who sponsored us, like I mentioned earlier, and she lives in a very affluent neighborhood where, you know, I would say. Yeah, 90% are Caucasian,
right.
And wealthy Caucasian. So I was fortunate enough where they actually have. I think that's probably the first class that I attended that they carve out a ESL class for me, and maybe probably just me and my brother. I don't recall anyone else in there, but everyone else is you know blue eyes, blonde hair. And you know, I remember one day, you know, every morning, basically, when you do it in elementary school, you stand up, you do the Pledge of Allegiance, right?
Right.
You know, it's a ritual for all the kids that go to school nowadays. Back then, today, you know, I didn't know. I go in there, sit down, I see everybody stand up, I stand up. You know, they put their hand on their hand, and they go, you know, basically, a Pledge of Allegiance. So you just follow. You don't know what to do, but you know. I'm always, I would say, probably 5-10 seconds behind everybody. So that's always like, you know, they didn't, you know, stand up or laugh at me in a certain sense, but it at least gives me a sense where it's self-conscious that I am different
right.
from these kids, not only but from physical appearance, but maybe because not knowing the language, not being able to communicate or not understand what the heck are they doing every morning, yeah. right? And just like, yeah. And we certainly don't do that when I was in China. So that was like, you know, it's like, wow, okay, what's going on? And I think at those moments when, you know, we were both sort of at the point where we could kind of understand what's going on around us, but what's going on around us has been completely different
right.
than what's happened to us in the first 9 years of our life. And from that point on, I remember, you know, just like from like first day that.
Yeah, it's actually interesting because I'm now remembering this thing that, like you said, it's completely different, right? The experience is different, especially with even the school content itself. I remember, again, in that class in San Diego, we had a math test, and it was just basic addition and subtraction. And I filled it out, did it, because, you know, I learned about addition and subtraction in Hong Kong, no big deal. Fill it out, turn it in, and the teacher marked most of it improper. She said it was kind of wrong because I didn't show my work, right? And it was like, you know, 3 digits minus another 3 digits,
right.
and subtract it.
Just do it in your head.
Do it in your head, get down the answer, and I'm done. And she marked through the whole paper. It's like, oh, you're supposed to show how you borrowed here and subtracted it. And I was like, okay, why? But yeah, that was actually pretty different. The education system and it's interesting. I don't remember having an ESL class in that school. I did have an ESL class when I came moved to LA and then was at Gates.
Well, so I think my disadvantage coming here is that I actually does not even know ABC. In the China school system, all we learn is pinyin, and the way you pronounce A is R. B is ba, you know, abba, zida, of a girl. It's like completely different, right? I'm glad I didn't make a fool out of myself trying to pronounce that in front of, you know, the teacher at the time. But
and it's actually probably harder if you've had that education in order to learn English because you're so used to the other pronunciation. Because a lot of friends I've known who were slightly older and they've learned that pronunciation previously, yeah. and they come here and they try to relearn English with the English sounds. It makes it much more difficult because they can't get rid of the habit of sounding it differently.
Well, there's definitely a challenge for me to make that switch, no doubt. But I think I was lucky enough to be here young enough where that switch can still happen, and you know, I could somewhat now communicate normally.
Well, obviously,
without a huge, too bad of an accent, nothing that anything wrong with that, but yeah, but that, yeah. that transition was happened to me where I could still young enough to make that transition.
You know, where we actually got a lot of practice with the language is we had to do a lot of translations from our parents. I mean, I don't know if you did the same thing, but when we came here, there was a lot of paperwork. Especially as a refugee moving into the US, there was a lot of paperwork. In order to fill it out, I had to go with my parents and help be a translator. At the time, back in, like, you know, when we came here in 1980s, was it 86, 87 or so, somewhere around there, there weren't translators available at most of the government facilities that we had to go to. There weren't even mostly translators when I tried to apply to school in San Diego. So I had to make do and kind of translate for my parents, tell them what was being said and then translate back, which for a kid at 9 was difficult and also strange because my vocabulary was limited in English at the time, definitely. But I think my vocabulary in Chinese was also limited because, you know, I was such a young kid. It's difficult to come up with words and even know what was being said. I remember when I was trying to translate this document that was saying, now I actually know what it is. That's saying if you had issues with whatever problem that's being discussed, you can apply for a hearing, right?
Right.
At the time, I translated to my parents as saying that it means if you have a problem with it, you can go get your hearing checked. Because yeah, to me that's hearing. What else could it possibly
mean? Right, exactly. And then if you have trouble understanding the letter or whatever the document is, and your parents give you a hard time, it's like, what do you go to school for?
Yeah, exactly. that's hilarious. I remember once when I said when my parents said they wanted to pick up some vegetables, some ong choy at the vegetable, and they asked me what ong choy in English is, and I said, I don't know. They said, why did you go to school if you don't know you can't say all the names of these vegetables?
Right. Right. No, so one thing to know is, and I'm glad you mentioned that, is that I think for you know, folks like you and I were the first generation, and you know, yourself as the first kid, where our parents are here, whether immigration or refugee, you know, when they don't know the language, and we become sort of the middleman,
right,
between, you know, what the possibility of opportunity is versus, you know, them trying to, you know, see it through your eye, kind of thing. It becomes very hard, especially in that young age. I mean, imagine, right? You're 9, 10 at the time.
Right.
And you have to translate, and you know, make sure you get this document right before, you know, for all you know, right, you could get kicked out of country.
Exactly. Fear. If you look at it and you translate something incorrect, and because of that you put in some incorrect information, you get kicked out.
Right. So I mean, there's a lot of pressure, right? And I think you and I realized that. And you mentioning that story remind me of a story, and it is it is a very embarrassing story. So my mom had us when she was really, you know, in her later age. So I think when she was almost 40. So by the time I'm 10-ish or so, she's close to 50. And at the time she hit her menstrual cycle, you know, that period that woman goes through. And I had no idea. I just remember one day, she dragged me to the hospital because obviously she's going through that phase, you know, she doesn't know. And, you know, basically I need to translate for her.
Yeah.
And for 10 years ago, I have no idea what menstrual cycle is. I have no clue what women go through. And I don't think my mom realized that because, you know, she obviously did not feel well because of her body. And she desperately needs someone to translate for her. She drags me to the hospital, and I end up translating. I have no clue what I need to translate. When the doctor asks, you know, when's the last time your mom had your period? I was like, and I was like, huh? And it was kind of embarrassing. And by the same time, it sort of emphasized the story that you just told, translating some important document. And you know, me being there, and what I realized today is a pretty critical moment of my mom's life, right?
Right.
And you know, obviously she's confused. She didn't know. She's not. She's going to do something that she might not be aware of. So I was totally lost, and I don't know how helpful I was to her. And I don't know how we got through it, but it's just just to say that we are put in a situation where we are actually burdening something that's really, really critical to the rest of, you know, the family or our loved ones.
Yeah.
Which I think, you know, our later generation, our younger brother, which I don't have, you have, might not realize or might not have been through.
Yeah, I think they, you know, my younger brothers are they probably got it a little bit easier in that you know, if it's translation work, I'll do it, right? Because I'm the oldest, I should have learned more, you know, so I do most of that. And since I've already gone through it, like when I apply for school, I've already gone through it, so I can tell them what to expect and so on and so forth. And I think even my youngest brother, by the time he rolls around and gets into school, there's a lot more translators actually available. They went in, you know, at a later few years. So it was actually an easier road for them. I wouldn't say it's completely easy or simple, but it's definitely easier in comparison to I think what we went through. So yeah, it was an adjustment.
It was an adjustment. It's definitely something that I think is lost in a sense that, you know, and it's different every generation. I say,
yeah.
You know, obviously today's generation go through something different than what we did. Not saying that we went through a tougher time or easier time for that matters. I mean, I think every generation has its own like nuances, and I think that's the exact nuances for our generation, and especially for people like us who need to immigrate or move to another country from you know, an Asian country or you know, for whatever country, to a brand new environment where we need to adapt and sort of like, you know, learn and adjust at a very young age and still be able to sort of do it and look back on it and laugh at it. And
yeah.
And when you and I sat down a couple months ago and decided to do this, that's sort of the exact thing that we want to do. Well, that's some very interesting, fascinating experience. If we don't tell the story, it might get lost.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's sit down, tell our stories. Folks might laugh at it, and they might even compare. Like you who's listening right now, might even compare to, you know, the stage that you're going through in life and say, hey, look, that's somewhat similar. Or, you know, oh, this is completely different. So it's wherever it is, wherever stage you are, and wherever you're listening to us on, you know, there's definitely common ground for every generation. And our goal, part of our goal, is not only to share a story, it's just to make that connection that, yes, there might be a generation gap between us, our parents, or us and our kids, but there's some commonality between every day.
Right. But it's kind of interesting. I would actually love to hear from a new immigrant now, right? With the advent of the internet, with social media, with everything being so global and connected, I wonder how much that experience, that immigrant experience, has changed since, you know, technically speaking, they would have been bombarded with all sorts of information about this country and about the way everything works. Through television, through social media backblast, or through movies or whatever, music. How much that they would they have anticipated that experience coming here? Because when we came, there was no connection, right? There was a complete wall of information. Knew nothing about the country, nothing really about the language or social behavior or what's been going on or what's important and not important. You know, so we came here kind of blind. But now with all that information, to the other countries flowing, pretty much free flowing everywhere. When you come to a new country, is it easier? Is it more difficult? Is it different? Because that's that shell shock of, it's not quite what I anticipated, but you know, close to it.
Right.
I'd love to hear somebody out there who has that experience to just like, let us know about it. Oh, that'd be great to compare with, I think.
Yeah, no, I would love to hear that as well. So for those of you who are listening, if you're one of those, feel free to leave a message in our email or blog. Maybe we'll get connected with you and hear your story. And I do think that, you know, to your point, it's got to be a less of a shell shock, because
right,
just because you have some sort of expectation,
right.
Versus you're just like, what's going on? Or
it could be the reverse. I mean, you have the expectation and you come here and it doesn't meet that expectation.
That's, yeah,
that'd be a punch in the face.
Okay, well, whatever it is, we really appreciate you listening to us. You know, hopefully you enjoyed this quick conversation, a very brief background about Andrew and I. We look forward to bring you more and more story about us. At the same time, we want to start hearing from you guys.
I'm sure there's a huge community out there. There's a lot more first generation immigrants, second generation. If you have a story to tell as well, share, you know, share. That's the only way we can compare notes and maybe even pass on some other, maybe we'll learn something from you. So, you know, we have emails, blog, our website too, adt.com, visit it and, you know, hopefully we'll grow this even further.
All right, until the next episode.
Take care.
Bye.